The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I'm Alex Protoski.
And I'm Alex Hearn.
Welcome to a very special edition of Tech Weekly.
On the show, we take an in-depth look at what is increasingly the byword for online digital money, Bitcoin.
Increasingly in the future, we're going to see more freelancers and more startup companies that are going to be making payments and doing their finances in Bitcoin.
If the Bitcoin creators are playing games with algorithms such that they're drip feeding coins in, and we're not quite sure when those coins are going to be drip fed into the system, we're not quite sure as an ordinary consumer when the value is going to fluctuate.
If one day Bitcoin became some kind of global currency, that would be amazing. And I think it's more likely to happen with Bitcoin than, you know, the dollar or the euro.
Where is Second Life? We thought we were all going to live in Second Life, go to school in Second Life. It was nonsense, of course. It didn't happen. I wouldn't be surprised if Bitcoin goes the way of Second Life.
This week, we tap into a range of expert opinions on the cryptocurrency Bitcoin. Philip Inman, The Guardian's economic correspondent, discusses the economic viability of Bitcoin with Mark Lamb from the CoinFloor Bitcoin Exchange.
Also, we hear from Bitcoin skeptic Harvard School of Business Associate Professor Ben Edelman and advocate and Bitcoin community member Mike Hearn. No relation.
Now, before we begin, if you need a Bitcoin primer, look no further.
Nakamoto left a paper on a popular cryptography blog which proposed a system of currency that solved all of these fiddly problems. His proposal was that instead of a bank or credit card company recording every transaction in one central ledger, all of the users would record all of the transactions at the same time.
Alex, you put together a 190-second, a three-minute intensive, let's see how I did that with my brain, quick guide to what Bitcoin is. How can we see that?
You can see that and all of our Bitcoin coverage at theguardian.com/technology/Bitcoin.
So, Mike Hearn is a good person for us to start with if we want to get to grips with the mechanics of what Bitcoin is and what it could be.
Yeah, my name's Mike Hearn, and I'm a British software developer who has been working on Bitcoin now since the second half of 2010. And I've mostly focused on developing smartphone wallets, the wallets for Android.
Yeah, when I spoke to Mike from his base in Zurich, Switzerland, I started out by asking him if his passion for Bitcoin was love at first sight.
No, actually, the opposite. When I actually first found Bitcoin in 2009, and I didn't start working on it then because there was no community, and there was no price, and there were no forums, and there was really nothing happening. So I just emailed back and forth with Satoshi and asked him a lot of questions. So I was very interested in the technology, but actually, eventually, I concluded that it wasn't radical enough, and I was interested in more radical ideas than Bitcoin. So it's funny how these things change, right? Because I thought, what's the success case for Bitcoin look like? Well, it's sort of digital cash. So even if it became very successful and took off, people would end up putting their Bitcoins back into Bitbanks so they could earn interest. And then the Bitbanks would go fractional reserve and they would start, you know, lending out Bitcoins they didn't have. And then they would need to be bailed out and eventually it would come full circle and we'd be back to square one. But back then I was more interested in community-based currency systems like Ripple.
But you changed your mind over time?
Yeah, I came to realize that my initial analysis wasn't quite correct in some ways. Eventually, I decided that the ability to be your own bank is still very powerful, even if people are investing their money with third parties. And in the end, I decided that probably wouldn't be how it would quite work out.
So whenever people hear about Bitcoin, they hear about this thing, mining. What does that actually entail? How does a computer mine for money?
Right, it's a bit of a strange concept, isn't it? The computer can just make money out of nothing by doing some calculations. Mining serves two purposes in Bitcoin. So the main purpose it serves is to create the record of every Bitcoin transaction that has ever been done. And this is fundamental to how Bitcoin works and why it's secure, because it's completely auditable. So when you actually download the Bitcoin core software from the Bitcoin.org website and run it, what it does is it downloads this log that the miners have created, which contains every transaction, and it effectively adds up all of the numbers to verify everybody's ownership of every Bitcoin, and eventually it calculates the final ownership. So you can see by looking at this log that no one has violated the rules at any point. No one is creating money out of nothing when they're not allowed to, things like that. And this is the fundamental way in which Bitcoin regulates its monetary base.
And the second aspect?
So the second aspect is a way of issuing the currency while it's still new in a way that's kind of fair. So, you know, every currency that has new money being created, which of course they all do, faces this problem of how do you make it fair? So most national currencies don't even really try and deal with this problem. They don't even talk about it really. And the money gets created by private banks and the central bank, effectively. And we just sort of assume that banks will do the right thing with it. And Bitcoin, Satoshi wanted everyone to have a chance of taking part in the initial issuance, but not just sort of randomly allocated, because for various technical reasons, that's a bit hard to do. It's much easier to reward people for doing some verifiable work. And then that's what mining also accomplishes. It's actually a way of issuing currency into circulation in such a way that the people who get it are being rewarded for doing work that's useful to the system, which is building this transaction log, the blockchain.
And so this second point of mining is what most people know about it. They know about it as a way to basically make money. It's being allocated. Why doesn't the first aspect get spoken about more? If mining is so crucial to the operation of Bitcoin...
the first aspect is a lot more boring, I guess. But also, the fact that it's called mining is a bit misleading, right? Because it's called that because it sort of vaguely resembles the process of mining for gold. But when you dig gold out of the ground, you're not accomplishing anything directly useful with that, right? You're just after the gold itself. There are no useful side effects to gold mining. Mining is a bit of a confusing term, because even after all the Bitcoins are issued many years in the future, there will hopefully, assuming Bitcoin's still around, there will still be mining going on. And at that point, it will be incentivized by fees, transaction fees, rather than the issuance of new money.
When mining began, people could do it on their home computers. I mean, we famously heard about James Howells, who mined 4,500 Bitcoin on a Dell laptop back in 2009. But now there's huge purpose-built data centers which do nothing but churn out Bitcoins every hour, every day. Is that slow, decentralized way that Bitcoin used to be mined, is that slowly dying? Are we seeing it all moving back to a big business style of operation?
No, I don't think so. So it's true that there are some miners who are really, really into it, and they run it as like a huge business, and they build these big data centers, but most of the mining equipment, at least as far as anyone can tell and anyone knows, is still in the hands of, you know, what you might call cottage industry people, right? Because mining is not something where you get good economies of scale. You know, if you put five mining computers next to each other, they use five times as much energy and require five times as much cooling as one. It's a very linear sort of scaling. So just being big doesn't give you many advantages. And what that means is it's perfectly possible, and lots of people have done this, for someone to order one of these devices and actually plug it in at home or in their basement or, you know, in their shed at the bottom of the garden or whatever, and actually, you know, take part in that mining process and earn a bit of money that way. It isn't possible to do with the regular computer that you have lying around anymore. You'd have to purchase some special hardware to do that because of the arms race and so on. But yeah, I mean, you can certainly still take part as an individual, and hopefully it will remain that way for the foreseeable future. But ultimately, as mining is not, you know, the fairness aspect is something that Satoshi tried to optimize, but it's not actually about, you know, as many people doing it as possible. It's actually about building this log. So, you know, if it does get slightly more centralized, that's not great, but Bitcoin will still work.
I mean, how important is Bitcoin's decentralized nature for you? Is this the key reason why you're behind it, or do you think that a little bit of concentration could be good for it, or could just leave it essentially the same? And, you know, and it would still be this groundbreaking digital currency.
For me, decentralization is really the main thing. It's really critical. It's why I was interested in it. It's what I've put all my work into, pretty much, keeping Bitcoin as decentralized as possible. It just makes sense. I mean, if you think about, you have large piles of money accumulating in one place. You know, if you agree that money is power, then inevitably these large pools of money are going to attract problems and cause problems with, you know, people abusing the power that it gives them. So decentralization of power over the financial system is, yeah, something that I believe in and I'm passionate about.
So
So as you can hear, the inherently decentralized nature of Bitcoin is at the heart of Mike's interest in the currency. And this is the very thing that causes many in the established financial system to question its viability.
And that's why we asked Philip Inman, the Guardian's economics correspondent, to discuss Bitcoin with Mark Lamb from CoinFloor, one of the UK-based Bitcoin exchanges. But before we hear that, I have a question. Alex, is a Bitcoin exchange like any kind of stock or currency exchange?
Yeah, it's essentially where you trade real money, and that's a phrase that'll get me into trouble, for Bitcoin. CoinFloor takes pound sterling and will give you Bitcoin in return, or takes Bitcoin and will give you pound sterling in return. Like any currency exchange, the price at which you buy and sell Bitcoin is set by the number of people trying to buy and sell Bitcoin. If there is a glut in supply, the price of Bitcoin will go down. If not enough people are selling Bitcoin, the price of it will go up. And from that, you work out the value of the currency.
Okay. So key to Bitcoin is its fixed supply, as we heard, and there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins. So I started by asking Philip Inman how this fixed supply affects this digital currency.
Well, obviously that turns it into something which has a particular value. I mean, that there's a certain amount around at the moment. There's going to be more in the future. And I think that's one of the things that you find with Bitcoin, which is a confusion which people have, which is whether it's something, a means of trade or and facilitates trade because it's like a pound or a dollar, or whether it's something that's an investment. It's something you're going to hold and therefore cling on to and not use to trade. You're going to bank it and hoping that the value is going to go up in the future.
Does this mean, though, that we should all buy it now? If, you know, if it's something that we're going to bank on, we're going to stick into, say, for example, CoinFloor, which is Mark's company, should we then stick it under our virtual bed mattresses or into our virtual sock drawers?
If it's an investment, if it's telling me that in effect I've got a gold coin and I'm going to sit on it and hope that gold gets more expensive and this Bitcoin gets more expensive, then I'm basically deciding that I prefer investment to work. And I think one of the trends that you see, particularly since the 1970s, when everything became more expensive, oil became more expensive, it became much harder to make work pay, to actually buy a house, to buy a decent lifestyle by working 9 to 5 each day. You wanted to win the lottery, and the Bitcoin is a way of winning the lottery. So I think that that's where its popularity becomes something that gains more and more sort of widespread traction around the world. Everyone wants to win the lottery, either through their clever brain. They've been born with a clever brain and they want to make use of it, so they invent a derivative of a Bitcoin, or they want to just be passively buying it and therefore hoping to sit on it and gain from its investment potential.
Mark, you want to respond to that?
So I would say, if you're classifying investment as something, an alternative to work, I mean, most people put funds in a bank, which is a sort of investment. The bank will then invest those funds. Most people, lots of people play around in the stock market. I would say classifying investment as thus not intending to work is probably a bit of a mischaracterization there, because most people, even if they are investing, and maybe even if they are very successful at investing, some people have been in Bitcoin, a lot of people still have to work and still have to, you know, bring in income.
It is interesting, actually, this idea. I've never really thought of it before, this idea of winning the lottery and how Bitcoin is the current sort of big winner. Is that simply because we are in a period with this particular currency in which it is in great flux and we have no idea? Would people win the lottery by investing in US dollars or, you know, or euros or whatever in the past?
I think Mark's right when he says that it can be recycled. Once I've bought it and put it somewhere, if a bank is willing to take it, then they will invest it in somebody. And if somebody can start a business and pay their employees in it, then obviously they can use that as investment seed capital, as it were, to then start a business and start making something. I think that process could happen if everybody starts to say, okay, I'm willing to agree that this Bitcoin has a certain value and I'm willing to take it as wages, or I'm an investor and I'm willing to take it as a dividend.
Right now we've seen a company which has raised VC funding in Bitcoin, has never used a bank account, and all of their employees have been paid in Bitcoin. This company operates all around the world. So today, we're starting to see this happen. Now, that company has to deal with the wild fluctuations, but they also get the upside of, you know, when the price goes up, they're sitting a little better. There are companies that are doing this, and I think increasingly in the future, we're going to see more more freelancers and more startup companies that are going to be making payments and doing their finances in Bitcoin and in the blockchain.
But do you think those employees are taking a risk, or do you think, because they're not taking much of a risk if they're paid in dollars, dollars are going to be pretty much the same value this year and next year, but...
Sure. They're definitely taking a risk. I mean, Bitcoin has been very volatile, and part of what we're doing and what a lot of other entrepreneurs are doing by trying to get the financial industry involved is helping the volatility go down as more liquidity arises and as it's traded more frequently. But it's less volatile than some currencies. I mean, anyone holding Argentinian currency is probably wishing they had held Bitcoin right now. They're positive,
but that's probably a poor example. In that I'm not going to say very pleasant things about the Argentine currency.
But if you were in Argentina, you would probably much prefer to hold Bitcoin. And there are a lot of parts of the world. You know, 3.5 billion people in the world don't have bank accounts. So for people in the West, where you have a bank account, you know, there's faster payments, there's credit cards and debit cards, there's all sorts of payment methods. Bitcoin does have advantages, but for people in developing countries, those advantages go from slight upgrades to the only way they can do financial services when the current system isn't really working out for them.
One of the bigger problems that I hear about with Bitcoin fluctuating in value is that even when it goes up, that can be bad for Bitcoin. You end up with this problem, which is loosely analogous to deflation. You're holding something which you want to spend, but you don't want to spend it today in case it's worth twice as much tomorrow. I mean, is it deflation? Can the normal ways that economists talk about deflation be applied to Bitcoin, Phil?
Well, it certainly can be applied to it in the sense that if you are in, you know, the common example is Japan. So if you're in Japan, you're delaying purchases that you might make today because you think prices will be lower tomorrow. And this is terrible for the economy because everyone's trying to make things and sell things, and yet consumers are always holding back and saying, okay, well, I'm not going to buy today, I'll buy tomorrow. And the same could apply to Bitcoin. I think one of the problems is that if the Bitcoin creators are playing games with algorithms such that they're drip feeding coins in, and we're not quite sure when those coins are going to be drip fed into the system, we're not quite sure as an ordinary consumer when the value is going to fluctuate because more come into the system. Now, obviously, I don't know when a central bank is going to flood the market with pounds or dollars as they have been doing over the last 5 years. But they've made a calculation they're making up for banks, ordinary banks, withdrawing funds, and they're trying to replace that money to keep the whole price of currencies steady. That's one of their missions. Is anybody out there doing that for Bitcoin?
That's actually a very, very good question. And the thing is, the fundamental importance of Bitcoin is that the creator has no power over the system. Everyone who's involved in Bitcoin doesn't have the authority to change Bitcoin at all because it's decentralized. It's as if the creator of email could come back and change the protocol. Because everyone now agrees on how an email protocol or some other internet protocol works, the rules are set and they can't be changed. So the rate of creation, it's a set rule, and there can be no flooding of the market by an initial creator of Bitcoin. That simply can't happen, which is the reason why Bitcoin is so important. It's decentralized. Central banks are centralized institutions. They control the rate of supply, and similarly, especially in developing countries, oftentimes things go awry. With Bitcoin, you have a completely decentralized central bank. Its supply creation is controlled mathematically by a protocol which can't be changed by anyone on Earth.
Similarly, the idea of the limit is completely set in place, and that absolutely cannot be changed. Is that correct?
Exactly. There's no one on Earth who can change that limit.
What if it becomes a problem? Could it become a problem, this kind of limit, Philip?
I would have thought it would become a problem if unless you believe in complete free markets and everyone has to take the roller coaster ride of whatever value you're putting on the currency at any one time. So what's tended to happen is that governments find that their populations will not tolerate wild fluctuations, and they want their governments to try and control the value of the currency, and they give power to a central bank who then try and either withdraw money or flood the market with money depending on which they think is going to stabilize the currency. There's plenty of people in America. I know it's very popular in America that the value of money should be whatever it is at any particular time, and we all take the rough and the smooth because you shouldn't mess around with the value of money. That's obviously a very free market view of money, and from my perspective, disregards its effect on people. I think the planet is about people, not money, so you would say you would want to manage it. But obviously there's a point of view that says you shouldn't manage it, you should just take the roller coaster ride.
I mean, Mark, why does there have to be a limit? Wouldn't it be just as possible to create a Bitcoin where 1 million coins were mined every year forever and you had a nice steady rate of inflation?
It would be possible, and many attempts have been made to do that. They've all failed because no one's been interested, for the most part, very few people or no one has been interested in holding those coins. The reason for the limit is the same reason why humans have used gold for 6,000 years as a money. They didn't use grass, they didn't use paper, they could have used leaves, but our species has chosen to use gold and other precious metals that are fundamentally limited in supply exists on Earth, because we've realized that any other asset can be either printed into obscurity or is just too abundant to be of any meaningful use as a transactional good and also a long-term storage of value. So when Bitcoin has a limit, it's basically saying, let's take the advantage of gold, which is the limited supply and the fungible quality of it, and let's add on the advantages of central banking currencies, which give us the ability for a complex financial infrastructure and transactions that can happen very quickly that are highly trusted. Bitcoin basically takes gold and central banks and merges them into a decentral bank with the limited supply and financial transactions that can happen anywhere on Earth instantly at near zero cost.
Philip, Mark has created a compelling argument for, in some ways, a hybrid between currencies that we recognize. So we've got gold as a precious metal, and we've got the central bank that has the authority to create the limited supply and also to create the balance that you were talking about, the stability. But looking more broadly beyond central banking and gold, are there any current or historical currencies that Bitcoin has similarities with? Can we point at whether it's an existing currency that has sort of hard currency, hard physical element associated with it, or even ephemeral currencies like tulips or Linden dollars or platinum pieces in EverQuest that we can say Bitcoin is similar to this?
No, I'm not sure you can say it's similar to tulips. If you've got something which has been created and cannot be dissolved, so these things are, even if you believe in the electronic bit, then you're happy to say that that still exists. Even if there's a nuclear explosion, they're still there when the tulips have all died. So if you accept that, then you've got bitcoins around and you've got them being created just as we've heard described. So I think it's new in that sense. I think what the problem is what we've talked about already a bit, which is this whole idea that if you've got something that where you've got panics, where you've got anything to do with the people's emotions around money, there is no control over how that affects the value, and we will see a yo-yoing value. And most people, so a small proportion of people, will be happy to take the risk of, they will feel secure in themselves, in their ability to generate money for themselves or whatever. They're happy to be paid in bitcoins, whether it's through dividends as an investor or wages as an employee. But most people won't. Most people want more certainty than that and will tell their politicians to get them more certainty. I think one of the things I hear from the Bitcoin community a lot is this issue of banking, and you raised it just now, was that banks are terrible. They charge lots of money for their facilities. If you want to send money around the world, buy, sell, whatever it is, banks charge, and this is ridiculous in an electronic age. What are they doing? You know, it's just a tax on everybody. And to some extent, that's true. And I think, you know, we should be looking at the banking system and saying it needs to be completely re-engineered. It is a tax on everybody. All the costs they apply are largely for their own benefit and nobody else's. So they can all walk off with bonuses and all the rest of it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you invent a Bitcoin. The Bitcoin is the answer. Maybe re-engineering the banking system is the answer.
So we've heard that Philip and Mark agree in principle on many of the strengths of Bitcoin, but not so much on the degree of risk inherent in investing in the currency as things stand. Now, Alex, since we recorded that conversation, it was announced that political parties in the US are actually taking donations in Bitcoin, and that Bitcoin itself has performed better than gold and silver. So risk and reward seem to be around every Bitcoin corner. What is the story with the US political parties?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually an interesting one. A lot of Bitcoin advocates thought it didn't go far enough. It's a political action committee, which is campaigning for what they call liquid democracy. Essentially, their end goal is to try and reach a stage where every single vote in Congress goes right back to the people. And it's not quite a sort of Swiss-style direct democracy, but it's something that's maybe a bit more techy than that and only really possible in the modern age. But as part of this goal, they know that they've got a very techy community they're trying to appeal to, and they wanted to be able to take donations in Bitcoin. But they actually requested specifically a limit of $100 on the amount of donations they could take, and they specifically requested the ability only to take donations from people who gave not only a name and address, but an occupation as well. In other words, the anonymous aspects of Bitcoin, they did not want to touch with a barge pole.
Clearly not. No, they're kind of in some ways negating exactly that aspect.
So for them, Bitcoin was very specifically nothing more than a currency which some of their donors might want to donate in.
Like Disney dollars.
Exactly. They don't want anonymous political donations, which to some Bitcoin fans is a terrible shame, because anonymous political donations are an amazing idea, and that's what Bitcoin is for them. It's the ability to exercise your money anonymously, and money is speech and speech is power and so on and so on.
And what about the relative stability of Bitcoin in comparison with gold and silver, especially gold? I mean, we're practically talking pork bellies here, aren't we?
The thing about Bitcoin is, compared to gold and silver, it is a minuscule market. The volume of currency that's traded into and out of Bitcoin is a fraction of a fraction of what's traded in gold and silver. In a way, and to Bitcoin advocates, what it is a high-growth technology stock. People who buy into Bitcoin are buying into the idea that it will become a billion or trillion-dollar currency that will be used worldwide, that will be easily the equal of PayPal or Western Union, or PayPal and Western Union combined, or PayPal and Western Union and Barclays combined. When you look at it with that sort of hope, even a 1 in 1,000, 1 in 1,000,000 chance of Bitcoin paying off that much means that if you buy it now, you would become very, very rich. But it also means that a tiny fraction of a fluctuation in the possibility of that happening can affect the value of Bitcoin hugely. Bitcoin being banned in China reduces that chance, so the value plummets. And then on top of all of that, you have the fact that it is still fundamentally quite a small system with not that many people buying in and out. So one person choosing to invest a large sum of money makes it rocket. Someone deciding to cash out makes it plummet. I think the political donations thing is actually a more interesting signpost to mainstream acceptance than just people trying to get rich off the latest tech gigor. With that in mind, let's go back to Mark and Philip's discussion. I asked Mark Lamb about how many and what sorts of people are actually using Bitcoin right now.
Most of the people that are using Bitcoin right now, a lot of them are speculating on it. A lot of them are using it to pay goods online. A lot of people are sending funds around the world with Bitcoin. But one thing we have to take into account is that Bitcoin right now has somewhere between 2 million on the low end and maybe 5 or even 8 or 10 million users on the high end, somewhere in that range. And the global money supply value is still around $6 or $7 billion. So that puts it somewhere in the range of a Central American country in terms of currency value. Now, when Facebook, although that's a company, but when email had that many users, the average person was not going to be interested in email. And now the reason why is because of Metcalfe's law and laws around network effects, when you have a network, the value of that network is proportional to the number of users, exponentially proportional to the number of users in that network, because two users can form one connection, five users can form more connections, and 10 users can form exponentially more connections. So when you have a few million people using Bitcoin, the value is very limited. When you start getting companies, big companies that are accepting Bitcoin for goods, we've seen several public companies in the US that are starting to accept Bitcoin for goods, the value of the network, not necessarily the currency, although that can also go up sometimes, but the value of the network goes up. And so what we see with Bitcoin is a network, just like a social network, and just like a network such as email or phone numbers. And as more people familiarize themselves with that network and say, oh yeah, this is something I could accept. Maybe they don't believe in the currency for speculative purposes. Maybe they just want to accept the Bitcoin and then turn them into pounds, sterling, or euros, or dollars. But they accept that Bitcoin can be used as a financial infrastructure layer. The more people are a part of that network, the more valuable it becomes.
But the big question for Bitcoin then is whether accepting that network needs to go hand in hand with accepting a view of economics which says that central banks are bad and that decentralizing a currency is important and that gold has a primal place in human exchange and trade. And are those two things as lumped together as people who are very behind Bitcoin seem to think they are?
No, they're not at all. I mean, we've seen the public companies in the US and the and there's even public companies here that accept Bitcoin, but there are companies all over the world and individuals all over the world who deal with Bitcoin and don't have any care or any political leaning or economic preferences towards Bitcoin or towards the kind of ideas that a lot of early Bitcoiners believed in. They can simply accept Bitcoin and then use a service like Coinbase or BitPay or many others to cash those Bitcoin immediately out into traditional currencies and then get those monies sent to their bank. They benefit from the Bitcoin users being able to send the money and pay them for goods and services, but they don't have to actually deal with the value, which at this stage, it is quite speculative. And what we have to understand is if Bitcoin gets to 50 million users and 100 million users and a billion users, the value will become much more stable. You're going to see the financial industry come in, create derivatives, create hedging products to be able to stabilize that value, create liquidity for Bitcoin.
Do you imagine creating liquidity is that a Bitcoin is going to be worth $1 million and we're going to be trading in parts of a Bitcoin?
Well, already people are trading in parts of a Bitcoin. When I go to the pub and buy a beer with Bitcoin, I don't spend one Bitcoin on it. I spend something like 0.005 Bitcoin.
Unless you're feeling really generous.
unless I'm feeling really generous towards the pub owner. But already people are spending and using small fractions of Bitcoin. Really, you can just say 5 quid worth of Bitcoin, and then the phone does all the calculations. So people are already trading and spending it this way. There'll be very creative names for these sub-fractions and sub-units, and they'll be popularized. We don't really need to worry about deflation too much. If Bitcoin does hit some astronomically large value, as it stands to do, if as many users came into Bitcoin as we believe they could, if Bitcoin did hit a large value, we would just use smaller sub-units. And that's not a problem at all.
Philip, given what Mark has been talking about, this idea of liquidity, this transfer from it as something to buy a beer with to something to invest with as well, do you think that Bitcoin as an entity has the qualities for long-term survival?
My concern is that when there is a problem, and that's what, we always say that there will be no problems, but there always is, and that... When Mark says about there being a whole kind of ecosystem around Bitcoin, which would be in effect self-regulating, and so you would have all kinds of hedge funds and others hedging in those currencies and helping anyone who's invested to offset their risk with them, and this would all go around the world. We've seen through Lehman Brothers that when risks were hedged with everybody, you would think, well, everyone's got a tiny bit of the risk and that makes everything fine. In fact, what it meant was that everybody was at risk and everyone panicked and the whole financial system looked like it was going down the toilet. Well, you want
to yeah, Mark's jumping in here.
One of the important things is when you have a central bank and then an entire financial infrastructure that is centralized, those risks become very centralized. When you have a decentralized financial infrastructure, one node or one company or one individual or one trade going south, one entity going awry, actually doesn't harm the entire ecosystem. For example, when Mt. Gox, which was a very large Bitcoin exchange, went bankrupt in Japan, CoinFloor was fine. CoinFloor wasn't affected. None of CoinFloor's users were affected. And most of the other Bitcoin exchanges around the world were completely unaffected. Now, this is just the difference between a centralized financial infrastructure and a decentralized financial infrastructure.
But on the other aspect of it is that the value has gone down and up. And I, as not someone who's rich enough to have a cushion against that, would suddenly find myself either very poor or very rich and unable to buy my groceries the next day or buy twice as many groceries the next day. I can't live with that because I have a low income. So that's a problem for me.
This is why it's probably not recommended for people to be 100% invested in Bitcoin at this point in time. We don't recommend that. It's volatile. I mean, it's just the way it is.
So Philip Inman makes the convincing argument that for the everyday person on a medium to a low income, Bitcoin is not yet a viable alternative to cash or other currencies. And it's this pragmatism that informs another skeptic of Bitcoin. Ben Edelman is an expert in negotiations, organizations, and markets at Harvard Business School. And our colleague Charles Arthur spoke with him about his thoughts on Bitcoin as a global currency.
So tell us what you think is the interesting thing about Bitcoin and the thing that doesn't quite work for you about Bitcoin.
The puzzle for me is who actually wants to use Bitcoin and why. If I want to make a purchase in a store, I much prefer to use my credit card, which gives me a 2% rebate. If I need to buy something and it costs $100 in the US, I take out my credit card, I swipe it through the machine, and when I get the bill at the end of the month, I only have to pay $98. I'm at a 2% discount below par. Now, suppose I wanted to buy something from Overstock.com, the online retailer that does accept Bitcoin. In order to get the Bitcoins, I'm going to have to pay a 1% premium over the exchange rate. So to get $100 worth of Bitcoins at the prevailing exchange rate, it's going to cost me $101. So now, to buy the $100 of merchandise from Overstock.com, I've spent $101 rather than $98. How could this possibly be in my interest? Now, Overstock.com is happy because they get a full $100 rather than probably $97 they would have gotten net of credit card fees. But they're going to have to pass some of that savings on to me to make me interested. Notice, of course, there's not enough savings for them to pass on to me. If they paid 3% for credit card fees, they'd have to give me the entire 3% in order to leave me equally well off. 101 minus 98 is 3. And at that point, they haven't gotten any savings at all. If the reason why they were excited about Bitcoin is that they wanted to get the savings, well, they've just given the whole savings to me as a rebate. The numbers don't end up adding up all the time for all the users. What you see among the users who were most excited about Bitcoin at the outset is they wanted to do illegal stuff, buy drugs and guns and murder for hire even. It's very clear why those customers want to use Bitcoin. They can't just pay for a murder with a credit card. Imagine what Visa would say to that. But for regular users buying regular stuff, it's not obvious to me that Bitcoin does a better job than the existing payment systems.
What about the situation that arose, for example, in Cyprus, where the government imposed restrictions on the amount that people could take out of their banks? It was, in effect, going to penalize all savings holders for the fact that they had savings because of the economic crisis that it was going through. And what seems to have happened is that a lot of those people, who were able to at least, transferred their savings into Bitcoin and moved them out of the country. I mean, for those people, surely Bitcoin has a utility which they wouldn't be able to find in any other way.
I guess I don't understand how that worked out for them. If they were able to transfer their money out to exchanges in other countries, then why wouldn't they just transfer their money to an account in London or Tokyo or New York? If they're able to get the money out into bitcoins, they could also get it out into other stuff, I should think. Now, maybe they wouldn't have wanted to keep it there in the first place. They would have wanted to get it out from the day they earn it. You immediately move it. But that's perfectly doable. One hears about people who work in Hong Kong and keep their money in British pounds in a London bank because they think that's safer. And that's fine, too. You can do that if you want to. We don't need Bitcoin and the massive amount of complexity of Bitcoin in order to achieve those benefits.
So do you see any situations where, I mean, apart from the anonymous contract killing sort of thing, any situations where you could say, oh, actually, yes, Bitcoin might be useful for that? I mean, perhaps currency speculation aside.
We should look for customers who are distinctively badly served by existing payment systems, customers who can't get what they need at a fair price from current payment infrastructure. One set of customers who really are taken advantage of, people who need to send money to other countries. If you work in one country, but you have friends and relatives in another and you want to support them, the fees that Western Union and Kin tend to charge can be quite high. It's not unheard of to spend 10% or even more. There should be a way to send money at a cost of less than 10%. Maybe Bitcoin could develop into that, but I have to say, Bitcoin isn't obviously all that well suited. For example, Bitcoin has so much complexity and uncertainty around it. These customers may not be the most sophisticated to understand changing values, changing exchange rates. If they send £100, they kind of want it to still be £100 when it gets there. Less a fee, but a predictable fee. You don't want half of it to evaporate when it's your hard-earned earnings sent to people who really very much need the money. Those customers, I think, would prefer to pay a modest fee for some assurance, for someone to call when it doesn't work. It's not that they want to pay a 10% fee, but neither do they need the complexity of Bitcoin and the many risks that Bitcoin seems bound to present.
So what do you think is the biggest obstacle to wider adoption of Bitcoin? Is it that people just don't understand the whole crypto element of it? Is it the fluctuating value? Is it the lack of liquidity? Is it difficulty in trusting exchanges? I mean, you know, how would you order that?
I would put at the top of the list not having an incentive to use it. So I've been using various schemes that let me pay at casual service restaurants in the United States. You take out your smartphone, you show a barcode, and you pay that way. And if they're willing to give me 10% off for doing it that way, I'm happy to participate. It's not that I really prefer this over paying by credit card, but I like to get 10% off. Bitcoin has the opposite problem, though. As discussed, rather than being cheaper, it's more expensive. If you make it cheaper for me, if you make it a better deal, it turns out there are a lot of people who want cheap stuff. They'll fly on Ryanair rather than on British Airways to save a surprisingly small amount of money. People would happily switch to a different payment mechanism rather than cash, rather than credit or debit cards, if you gave them an economic incentive to do so. But I'm not sure the numbers actually line up to give that kind of incentive.
Ben Edelman there, fairly certain that Bitcoin has yet to have a real practical value for a mass market. But Mark Lamb thinks, contrary to Edelman's doubts, that Bitcoin's value in niche markets is a strength. Let's take up our discussion with him and Philip again.
So credit card companies give discounts on their standard fees, which are about 3.5%, 2.8 to 3.5%. But Bitcoin, the fee for most Bitcoin transactions, at least ones that I've spent, was less than a penny, or maybe at most a few pennies. So credit card companies can give discounts, but Bitcoin's fees are still better. There's a lot of use cases for Bitcoin anywhere where there's problems with payments, anywhere where there's a lot of payment costs, the credit card industry, the remittance industry, the gaming industry for payments, and then anywhere where you want increasing accountability and increasing trust. Bitcoin is the most accountable payment system on Earth. We just published Provable Solvency, which is essentially a way for any user to check that we have their funds stored with us. You can't do that if you put funds into a hedge fund or a bank or some other financial institution.
Will there come a time when Bitcoin or its equivalent takes over? Well, possibly. I mean, there's certainly a lot of people inside government, the UK government, and I suspect probably the US government as well, who believe in creative destruction. And by that, I mean that they think that they are classical free market capitalist believers, and they know that things can become ossified and sclerotic and monopolized by certain groups. And so you have to destroy that in order to recreate and have a reborn capitalism. And so they will do this with all kinds of services, which they will encourage, which destroy existing services. And you could take it to an extreme where you destroy the currency in favor of a new kind, because you can't persuade the banks to cut their fees. You can't persuade the banks to behave differently. They're so entrenched. They've got so much to lose that you have to, as a politician, encourage a Bitcoin to come along and destroy them from the outside, because you can't from within.
Mark, to what degree are the political intentions of Bitcoin part of what Philip's arguing, but also part of the raison d'etre of Bitcoin?
I don't know that Bitcoin has political intentions. I think a lot of the people who are passionate about Bitcoin and involved in starting Bitcoin companies and owning Bitcoin have political intentions. But Bitcoin itself is just a protocol like the internet or email. And we are seeing governments very interested in Bitcoin. CoinFloor and myself have approached the UK government. We've talked to people at Number 10 and the Cabinet Office. We've been very interested in them regulating Bitcoin institutions. They are not as interested. The FCA are not as interested. So far, I think governments, they're probably going to stay out of the way for a while. A lot of entrepreneurs all around the world want to see Bitcoin, but want to see their companies and other Bitcoin institutions regulated because of trust and consumer protection issues. But right now, I think we're seeing governments staying out of the way, saying, "Okay, let's see what happens with this thing, and let's see where it goes before we touch it." And I think fortunately that's worked out pretty well.
Well, Philip Inman and Mark Lamb, thank you both very much for coming in today.
And that's all we have for you on this special Bitcoin edition of Tech Weekly. As we said earlier, you can see a video animation explainer on our site at theguardian.com/technology/Bitcoin. Tech Weekly was produced by Jason Phipps.
But from me, Alex Kratosky.
And from me, Alex Hearn.
Goodbye. Oh, we did that well.
'Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.